Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, September 29th, 2025 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather, abundant sunshine, highs to 92 degrees Fahrenheit, winds northeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight's forecast, clear skies, lows to 66 degrees Fahrenheit, wind south-southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts sunny skies, highs near 95 degrees Fahrenheit, winds south-southwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. We'll begin with the reading of the first article on the Arizona Daily Star front page titled, Four Die in Flooding. This article was written and presented by the Associated Press, Dateline Globe. Four people died after heavy rain caused flooding in Arizona, including three in this rural 19th century mining town, where floodwaters on Friday forced people to seek safety on rooftops and washed out a propane distributorship scattering about 1,000 tanks downtown. About 2.5 inches of rain fell in Globe, a city of about 7,250 people, about 100 miles north of Tucson, over 24 hours, and another storm moved in on Saturday, temporarily halting the search for people possibly missing in the flood because of the high-flowing creeks. Streets flooded in the nearby mining town of Miami on Saturday, but no injuries were reported, Carl Melford, emergency manager in Gila County, said. Meanwhile, about 20 tourists stranded in parts of the Havasupai Reservation, including at scenic Havasu Falls, because of flooding, were evacuated, Bureau of Indian Affairs dispatcher Shailene Gonzalez said. The remote reservation, reachable only by foot, mule, or helicopter, lies deep in the gorge off the Grand Canyon. It's popular worldwide for its scenic, towering, blue-green waterfalls, but is prone to flooding. In Globe, the bodies of two people were earlier found in a vehicle and another person was found in the floodwaters, Melford said. They were not immediately identified. In Globe, one of Arizona's oldest mining towns, sheriff's officials were looking into reports of people who may be missing, Melford said, but could not specify a number. We now have a massive search and rescue underway, he said. Rain poured down and quickly flooded the downtown area Friday, Melford said. One of the first areas hit was a propane tank distributor sending about 1,000 residential-sized tanks throughout the community, he said. There's propane tanks everywhere throughout the downtown Globe, he said. The city is near canyons that can funnel water from the mountains into the community very quickly. This was an extremely heavy amount of rain in an extremely short period of time, he said. Videos shared on social media showed vehicles in Globe being swept away by rushing muddy water with some smashed up against poles and large propane tanks scattered around. Authorities are asking residents to not go out searching in the floodwaters because search and rescue officials are accompanied by dogs who might pick up the scent of aspiring volunteers instead of possible flood victims. If people want to help, they should start by assisting friends and neighbors in need, Melford said. Globe City Council members declared an emergency, saying they have never seen anything like that, like the flooding. Scores of people have stepped up to volunteer, said Mayor Al Gameros, adding that many buildings in the community's downtown have been damaged. Officials asked people to stay away from the area until they can ensure it's safe to go in there. Our primary, again, is search and rescue, Gameros said Saturday. Another person was found dead Saturday morning near a vehicle caught in the floodwaters in suburban Phoenix the night before. The vehicle appeared to be empty after it was spotted partially submerged in about 8 feet of fast-moving water on Friday evening in a Greenbelt Park area, the Scottsdale Fire Department said. After the water dropped a bit overnight, crews found the body of a person pinned underneath the walkway bridge, the department said. The next front-page article is titled, Church Shooting, Fire Kills Four in Michigan. This article was written by Isabella Vollmart and Curry Williams of the Associated Press, Dateline Grand Blanc Township, Michigan. A gunman opened fire inside of a Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints chapel in Michigan during a Sunday service and set the building ablaze, killing at least 4 people and injuring 8 others. People shot and killed a suspect, authorities said. Hundreds of people were inside the church in Grand Blanc Township when a man rammed a 4-door pickup with two American flags on the truck bed through the front door, then got out of the vehicle and started shooting, Police Chief William Rene told reporters. Investigators believe he deliberately set the building on fire, Rene said. Officers responded to a 9/11 call and were at the church within 30 seconds and killed the shooter about 8 minutes later, Rene said. After the suspect left the church, two officers pursued him and engaged in gunfire, the chief said. Flames and smoke could be seen pouring out from the church for hours before the blaze was put out. Rene identified the suspect as Thomas Jacob Sanford, 40, from neighboring Burton. Rene did not specify a motive at a news conference on Sunday evening. Police cordoned off the street leading to the suspect's home. Rene said one of the wounded people was in critical condition Sunday evening and 7 others were stable. The bodies of 2 of the victims were found as authorities searched the debris in the church, Rene said, emphasizing the search was continuing and that more victims could be found. Earlier in the day, Rene had said authorities believed they would find more victims once they could sift through the wreckage and find where the fire was. Investigators were searching the suspect's residence in nearby Burton. Authorities did not provide any additional details about the suspect, including whether he was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, widely known as the Mormon Church. It was the latest of many shooting attacks on houses of worship in the U.S. over the past 20 years, including one in August that killed 2 children during Mass at the Church of the Annunciation in Minneapolis. President Donald Trump said in a social media post that he was briefed on the shooting and applauded the FBI for its response. Local authorities said the FBI was sending 100 agents to Grand Blanc Township, a community of roughly 40,000 people outside Flint. Pray for the victims and their families. This is an epidemic of violence in our country. It must end immediately, Trump wrote. The church building, circled by a parking lot and a large lawn, is near residential areas and a Jehovah's Witnesses church. Brad Schneerman, whose home is about 400 yards from the church, told the Associated Press that he and his daughter heard 2 rounds of 4 to 5 shots around 10:30 a.m. Then we really didn't hear anything for a while before they left their home to see what was going on. Timothy Jones, 48, said his family is part of another Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints congregation or ward about 15 minutes away. But that his children were at the Grand Blanc Township ward Saturday night for a youth fall festival. He and his family moved to Flint 2 years ago, in large part because how strong the faith community is in the area, he said. As people in his congregation got word of the shooting from texts and phone calls during their Sunday service, his ward went into lockdown and police came as a precaution, he said. His children were frantically just trying to get word that people were okay. Sundays are supposed to be a time of peace and a time of reflection and worship, Jones said. Yet in the wake of violence in other houses of worship, a shooting feels inevitable and all the more tragic because of that, he said. The shooting occurred the Monday after Russell M. Nelson, the oldest ever president of the Utah-based faith, died at 101. The next president is expected to be Dallin H. Oaks, per church protocol. The church is in communication with local law enforcement as the investigation continues and as we receive updates on the condition of those affected, spokesperson Doug Anderson said. Places of worship are meant to be sanctuaries of peacekeeping, prayer, and connection. We pray for peace and healing for all involved. When striking nurses at nearby Henry Ford Genesis Hospital heard about the shooting, some left the picket line and ran the short distance to the church to help first responders, Teamsters Local 332 President Dan Glass said. Human lives matter more than our labor dispute, Glass said. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer said in a statement that her heart was breaking for the community. Violence anywhere, especially in the place of worship, is unacceptable, she said. The impact spread quickly to neighboring communities, including a small city that shares a name with the township. Although we are two separate governmental units, we are very cohesive communities, said City of Grand Blanc Mayor John Creasy. That sort of thing is painful for our entire community. The next article from the front page of the Arizona Daily Star is titled, About to Be Organ Donor Was Alive on Operating Table. This article was written by Carrie Anthony of KFF Health News, Dateline St. Louis. Lying on top of an operating room table with his chest exposed, Larry Black Jr. was moments away from having his organs harvested when a doctor ran breathlessly into the room. Get him off the table, the doctor recalled telling the surgical team at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital as the team cleaned Black's chest and abdomen. This is my patient. Get him off the table. At first, no one recognized Zonny's Johnny in his surgical mask. Then he told the surgical team he was a neurosurgeon assigned to Black's case. Stunned by his orders, the team members pushed back. Zonny said, explaining that they had consent from the family to remove Black's organs. I don't care if we have consent, Zonny recalled telling them. I haven't spoken to the family and I don't agree with this. Get him off the table. Black, his 22-year-old patient, had arrived at the hospital after getting shot in the head on March 24, 2019. A week later, he was taken to surgery to have his organs removed for donation, even though his heart was beating and he hadn't been declared brain dead yet, Zonny said. Black's sister Molly Watts said the family had doubts about after agreeing to donate Black's organs, but felt unheard until the 34-year-old doctor in his first year as a neurosurgeon intervened. Today, Black, now 28, is a musician and the father of three children. He still needs regular physical therapy for lingering health issues from the gun injury. And Black said he is haunted by what he remembers from those days while he was lying in a medically induced coma. I heard my mama yelling, he recalled. Everybody was here yelling my name, crying, playing my favorite song, sending prayers up. He said he had tried to show everyone in his hospital room that he heard them. He recalled knocking on the side of the bed, blinking his eyes, trying to show he was fighting for his life. Organ transplants save a growing number of lives in the U.S. every year, with more than 48,000 transplants performed in 2024, according to the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network, which oversees the nation's transplant system, and thousands die awaiting donations that never come. But organ donation has also faced ongoing criticism because reports of patients showing alertness before planned organ harvesting. The results of a federal investigation into a Kentucky organ donation nonprofit, first disclosed by the New York Times in June, found that during a four-year period, medical providers had planned to harvest the organs of 73 patients despite signs of neurological activity. Those procedures ultimately didn't take place, but federal officials vowed in July to overhaul the nation's organ donation system. Our findings shows that hospitals allowed the organ procurement process to begin when patients showed signs of life, and this is horrifying. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said in a statement, the entire system must be fixed to ensure that every potential donor's life is treated with the sanctity it deserves. Even before his latest investigation, Black's case showed Zonny that the organ donation system needed to improve. He was initially hesitant to talk to KFF Health News when contacted in July about Black. But Zonny said his patient's story had stuck with him for years, highlighting that while organ donation must continue, little is understood about human consciousness, and determining when someone is dead is the critical but confusing question at play. There was no bad guy in this. It was a bad setup. There's a problem in the system, he said. We need to look at the policies and make some adjustments to them to make sure that we're doing organ donation for the right person at the right time, in the right place, with the right specialists involved. L.J. Punch, a former trauma surgeon who was not involved with the case but reviewed Black's medical records for KFF Health News, questioned whether Black's injury from gunfire possibly contributed to how he was treated. Young Black men like Larry Black are disproportionately victims of gun trauma in the United States, and research on such violence is scant. His experience exemplifies the general neglect of Black men's bodies, Punch said. That's what comes up for me, Punch said. Structurally, not individually, not any one doctor, not any one nurse, nor any one team. It's a structural reality. The hospital declined to comment on the details of Black's case. SSM Health Kim Hendrickson, president of St. Louis University Hospital and St. Mary's Hospital, St. Louis, said, "The hospital system approaches all situations involving critical illness or end-of-life care with deep compassion and respect." Mid-America Transplant, the federally designated organ procurement organization serving the St. Louis region, does not comment on individual donor cases, according to Lindsay Spear, executive chief president for organ procurement. She did tell KFF Health News that her organization has walked away from cases when patients' conditions change, though not as late as when they are in the operating room for harvesting. "Let me be clear about that. It happens way before then," she said. "It definitely happens multiple times a year when we get where we get consent. The family has made the decision. We approach. We get consent. It's all appropriate. And then a day or so later, they improve, and we're like, whoa." But Spears said the recent media stories about the nation's donation system are prompting a lot of questions about a process that also does a lot of good. "We're losing public trust right now," Spears said, "of the industry, and we're going to have to regain that." It was a Sunday afternoon when gunshots rang out in downtown St. Louis. Black had been on his way to his sister's apartment. "I don't know. I was shot at first," Black said, sitting in his living room 6 years later. "I literally land like a block or two away." He collapsed moments later and said, he said, crawling to the back door of a woman's home where he asked for help. He said he asked the woman to give him two large towels, one covered in rubbing alcohol, another soaked with hydrogen peroxide. He wrapped those towels around the back of his head. When Sister Michael Payne found him, he was lying on the ground near the leasing office of her apartment complex. A crowd gathered around him. Before the ambulance took him to the hospital, Black told his sister not to worry about him. "I'm hearing Larry say, 'I'm good,'" says Payne recalled. "I'm okay." Black said he went in and out of consciousness on the way to the hospital, and once he was there, "I go to hitting my hand on the side of the ICU bed," Black said. "There was like, that's just the reaction, the side effects of the medicine. Ask him some questions." Payne said he asked her mother to blink twice if he could remember his first pet, a dog named Little Black that looked like a chihuahua from the Taco Bell commercials. Black said he remembers blinking twice. His sisters remembered the same. Payne asked him another question. This time she wanted to know whether her brother recognized their family. Black said he blinked twice when he saw his mom and sister standing nearby. Black said his sister then asked him the main question that everyone needed him to answer. She's like, "If you want them to pull the plug, if you're tired and giving up, blink once." Black recalled, "If you still got some fight in you, blink more than once." Black said he started blinking and hit the bed to let his family that he was still with them. The sisters said hospital staffers told them the movements were involuntary. In a waiting room steps away from the hospital's intensive care unit, a woman carrying brochures explaining to Payne and the rest of the family that Black had identified himself as a possible donor organ on his ID. The woman wanted to know whether the family wished to move forward with the process if Black died, Payne said. "I remember my mom saying, 'Not right now,'" Black's sister recalled. "It's kind of too soon." Payne said the woman persisted. She was like, "Well, can I at least leave you some brochures or something?" Payne recalled. "Then my mom got a little agitated because she felt like she was being, like, pushy." The family was already acquainted with the organ donation process. In 2007, Black's teenage brother Miguel Payne drowned at a local lake. His organs were donated, Miguel Payne said, noting the family was told that his body parts and tissues helped multiple people. I believe in saving lives, Payne said, but don't be pushy about it. Mid-America Transplant handles the organ transplant process for 84 countries and counties in parts of Illinois, Arkansas, and Missouri, including St. Louis. Like the Kentucky organization, it is one of 55 federally designated nonprofits that facilitate organ donations throughout the country. The nonprofit has never pressured a family into organ donation, Spears said. Registering to be an organ donor is legally binding, she said, but Mid-America has walked away from cases when families didn't want to move forward. She said her staff tries to dispel myths about organ donations and alleviate concerns. We want to have the families leave with a positive experience, Spears said. Despite the family's initial ambivalence, they ultimately consented to move forward with donating Black's organs. Watts said members of her brother's care team had told the family that her brother was at the end of the road. The family was told to prepare for Black's last walk of life, Payne said, also known as an honor or hero's walk. The tradition honors the life of an organ donor before the harvesting process begins. At the time, Payne said she thought her brother still had a fighting chance. She asked the hospital staffers to take another look at him before he was wheeled down the hall. I'm like, my brother's in there tapping on the bed, Payne said. They said, that's just his nerves. But I'm like, no, something's not right. It's like he was too alert. He was letting us know, please don't let them do this to me. I'm here, I can fight this. They were saying that's what the medicine will do. It affects his nerves. After the family had agreed to move forward with the organ donation process, the two sisters said an especially helpful member of Black's medical team no longer treated them the same way. She became standoffish. You could tell the dynamics had changed, Watts said. The family put the blue jumpers for the walk of life. We just walked around the floor and everybody was like acknowledging him, Payne said. We just thought this was the end. A friend of Black went to high school with filmed part of the ritual. In a short clip, Black is seen wheeled on a stretcher down a hallway in the hospital. His eyes are half open. People are crying. False rumors then started to swirl outside the hospital. Brianna Floyd said she went into shock when she heard that her friend was dead. She knew that Black had been shot in the head, but a few days earlier, a local newspaper had reported that he was in stable condition. Floyd checked Facebook to see whether the news of his death were true. Her timeline was flooded with farewell posts for Black, so she decided to write one too. I love you so much, brother, Floyd wrote. Never thought I would say that. Black's father rushed into the hospital when he heard a rumor that his son was being wheeled into the morgue. He's gone, Lawrence Black Sr. recalled being told. He's going to the freezer now. Black Sr. said he refused to believe that his son was dead. The thought was devastating. He had already experienced that kind of loss to gun violence. You wake up and nothing's the same, Black Sr. said. The spirit is lingering for about a week and you can feel it, you know. Overwhelmed with emotion, he prayed for his son to live. Zoni, the neurosurgeon, said he heard an announcement about a hero's walk over a loudspeaker in the hospital. He wasn't familiar with the term, so he asked about it. Medical residents in the hospital explained and told Zoni that the walk was possibly for his patient, Larry Black. No, that can't be my patient, Zoni told him. I didn't agree. That's when Zoni called the ICU to check on Black's status. A person who answered the phone told him that Black was being wheeled into an operating room, he said. This is my first year, Zoni said. The first year out as a neurosurgeon is the riskiest time for you. Any mistakes, anything small, basically derails your career. So the moment this happened, my legs went weak. And I was like nervous because at the end of the day, your job as a doctor is to be perfect. KFF Health News, Zoni and Punch all reviewed the medical files given to Black from his hospitalization. It's not clear from the records what led to that moment. In any case, the patient must be declared legally dead by the hospital's medical team before organ procedure begins. This is not negotiable, MedAmerica Transplant CEO and President Kevin Lee wrote in an August 21st blog post on the nonprofit's website, responding to the news and federal comments about the investigation centered in Kentucky. MedAmerica Transplant strictly follows all laws, regulations, and hospital protocols throughout the process. He said in a statement to KFF Health News that a person can be pronounced dead in two ways. A person is legally dead if their heart stops beating and they stop breathing, which is when donations after cardiac death can occur. A person can also become an organ donor if their brain, including the brain stem, has irreversibly ceased functioning, which is when brain death donation can occur. Every hospital has their own process in declaring both types of death, Spear said in a statement. MidAmerica Transplant ensures hospitals follow their policies. But Black didn't fall into either category zone, he said. And he said Black hadn't had what is known as a brain death exam. Zoni said he immediately informed his chairman about the situation, then started running to the operating room. Black's family was waiting in the hallway, unaware of the drama happening behind a set of closed silver doors. Then Zoni emerged, pulling Black's family into an empty operating room that was nearby. I remember he told my mama, I can't kill your son, Payne recalled. She said, excuse me? Zoni put an image of Black's brain on the screen. Then he circled the part of the brain that was damaged. He explained that Black's gunshot wound was something that he could possibly recover from, though he might need therapy. He asked the family whether they were willing to give Black more time to heal from his injury instead of withdrawing care. In my opinion, no family would ever consent to organ donation unless they were given an impression that their family member had a very poor prognosis, Zoni said. I never had a conversation with the family about the prognosis because it was too early to have that discussion. Zoni knew he was taking a professional risk when he ran into the operating room. The worst case scenario for me is that I lose my job, he recalled thinking. Worst case scenario for him, he wrongfully loses his life. Later, Zoni said, a hospital worker who transported Black from the ICU to the operating room told Zoni that something had seemed off. I remember him looking at me and saying, I'm so glad you stopped that, Zoni recalled. And I said, why? And he said, I don't know, his eyes were open the whole time, and I just felt like he was looking at me. His eyes didn't move, but it felt like he was looking at me. After Zoni's intervention, Black was wheeled back to the ICU. Zoni said the medical team held back all medication that caused his sedation. Black woke up 2 days later, Zoni said, and then started speaking. Within a week, the neurosurgeon said he was standing. I had to learn how to walk, how to spell, read, Black said. I had to learn my name again, my social, my birthday, everything. Zoni continued to care for Black during what remained his 21 days at the hospital. During a follow-up appointment, he posed for a photo with Black and his older sister, Watts. Next to Zoni, Black was standing up, a brace on his leg. It's a miracle that despite flawed policy, we were able to save his life, Zoni said. It was an absolute miracle. Zoni, who was working as a fellow and assistant professor at the time, left St. Louis University Hospital for another job later that year when his fellowship ended. He said Black's story made him question what we know about consciousness. He's now working on a new method that quantifies consciousness. Zoni said it could possibly be used to help measure consciousness from brain signals, such as with an electroencephalogram, or EEG, a test that measures electrical activity in the brain. Zoni said his method still needs rigorous validation, so he recently started a medical research company called Zeta Analytica, separate from his work at the West Virginia University Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute, which he'll begin in October. We don't understand the brain to the level that we should, especially with all the technology we have now, Zoni said. Today, Black is trying to move forward. He said he has seizures, but he has seizures if the bullet fragments in his head move around too much. He said he easily overeats because of the injury. He doesn't blame his family for their decision, but he questioned the organ transplantation process. It's like they choose people's destiny for them just because they have an organ donor ribbon on their ID. Black said, and that's not cool. To help him process everything that happened to him in 2019, he makes music under the name of Beam Navy Loney. I'm back from the dead, he recently wrote in a song about his experience. Earlier this year, Black celebrated the birth of another son who was sleeping peacefully at home, as Black recounted his story. He doesn't really cry, Black said. He just makes noises. Black said with a firearm within reach, he said he keeps the gun close to protect his family. It's still hard for him to sleep at night. Nightmares about what happened both on the street and in the hospital keep him awake. He said he no longer wants to be an organ donor registry. We'll now pause to remind you that you are listening to the broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles. The title of the first article is Justices Question Campaign Fund Laws. This article was written by Taylor Seeley of the Arizona Republic. The Arizona Supreme Court appeared willing to overturn the state's popular law requiring people who spend thousands of dollars to influence the outcome of elections to identify themselves. Considering a challenge to the Voters' Right to Know Act, the justices expressed concern about potential threats of violence from disclosure, asked whether the law imposed undue burdens on political participation, and questioned whether the state's constitutional framers would have prioritized disclosure above free speech and privacy. Such questions don't necessarily portend the outcome of the case and may merely reflect justices testing the limits and weaknesses of arguments. The law, an effort to rid Arizona elections of so-called dark money, was passed by a decisive 72% of state voters in 2022. It aims to eliminate anonymous political spenders for donors who give at least $5,000 to groups that spend at least $50,000 on statewide elections. A full or even partial repeal could significantly affect campaign finance regulation in the state. Challengers hope to replicate the playbook of other states if they are successful. Overturning the measure could represent a significant loss for the law's proponents, such as former Arizona Attorney General and Phoenix Mayor Terry Goddard, who spent years advocating for it. It would also undercut efforts by Campaign Legal Center, a nonprofit legal organization that advocates for dark money disclosures laws nationwide. The center played a critical role in drafting Arizona's law and has pointed to it as a big success. The law also is facing another legal challenge from Arizona's lawmakers, who have argued it violates the separation of powers. The Arizona Court of Appeals deemed one section of the law unconstitutional, and now the Supreme Court must decide what that means for the law as a whole. An opinion is expected September 29th. The Arizona Supreme Court includes seven justices. Six of the seven were appointed by Republican governors, five from former Governor Doug Ducey and one from former Governor Jan Brewer. Justice Maria Elena Cruz was appointed by sitting Governor Katie Hobbs, a Democrat. Cruz recused herself and was replaced by retired Justice Rebecca Birch, who served on the High Court from 2002 to 2014. Birch was appointed by former Governor Jane D. Hull, a Republican. Court spokesperson Alberto Rodriguez said justices do not have to provide an explanation for recusal. Three of the justices, Vice Chief Justice John Lopez and Justices Bill Montgomery and Clint Bolick, all appointed by Ducey, seem to suggest Arizona's framers intended to shield anonymous political spending on ballot initiatives and independent expenditures because they did not include such expenditures in the Arizona Constitution. Arizona's Constitution only requires disclosure of donors who contribute directly to candidates' campaigns. The lawmakers who wrote the state constitution between 1910 and 1912 had initially considered a more expansive mandate to disclose all contributions for the purpose of influencing an election, but ultimately left that out. It doesn't seem like open-ended authorization, but rather a very limited directive, Bullock said. Independent expenditures are political expenses made for or against an election issue or campaign, but with no coordination for the politician or campaign. Initiatives are laws placed on the ballots for consideration, either by the legislature or through public petitions, that voters then approve or reject. Attorneys for the state told justices that they should take the opposite message. Attorney Eric Frazier said that the fact framers made such a mandate about openness for spending on candidates shows that campaign finance disclosure was a core value of our founders. He said the Constitution's disclosure requirement does not set a ceiling, it sets a floor. He pointed also to another provision in the Constitution that bans corporate spending on elections, saying, "This is a pro-disclosure Constitution." Alexander Samuels, another attorney for the state, said, "The framers' discussion was, this is a Constitution, so we're merely setting a baseline, and we'll leave the legislature to do the rest." Suggesting otherwise, he said, means the legislature and the people have no discretion whatsoever. That cannot be the case. When Bullock asked whether mandatory disclosure was the government's forcing someone to say something against their will, Frazier said there were a myriad government disclosure requirements, such as those that home sellers may have to make about having pools in their backyard. Montgomery countered, none of those disclosures necessarily could result in someone being threatened or intimidated. There are people who have engaged in speech and they have been threatened, and they have a reasonable fear of being threatened. It's not lost on us what happened yesterday. Oral arguments took place September 11th, the day after the conservative political activist Charlie Kirk was assassinated while debating college students on campus in Orem, Utah. Frazier said there was no evidence that disclosure laws specifically were to blame for any violence, and that instead, violence usually occurred to public-facing leaders of organizations. He said many nonprofits publicize their boards of directors, yet those individuals aren't threatened. We have to consider that our founders looked at the risks and benefits of disclosure versus allowing people to remain anonymous, and they chose disclosure. Frazier replied, they chose sunlight over darkness. Bullock seemed unpersuaded. They also chose to protect speech and to protect private affairs, he interjected. Bullock said the law puts speakers in a position where they have to ask permission before donating to causes they care about. His question was a reference to a portion of the Voters' Right to Know Act that creates a process for political donors to get permission to opt out of disclosure requirements by either a state court or the Citizens Clean Elections Commission. It's for cases where disclosure would pose serious risk of physical harm. Bullock questioned how that didn't contradict the spirit of the Constitution's protections for speaking freely and for privacy. Arizona's Constitution protects people's ability to freely speak. It's a right of the public, whereas the First Amendment is a ban on government suppressing its public speech. Chief Justice Ann Timmer and Justices James Bean and Montgomery had also questioned it. Timmer wondered how far in advance a spender would need to seek permission. Montgomery said he was concerned that an administrative agency was given authority to decide questions involving constitutional rights. Attorney Andrew Gould, a former Arizona Supreme Court justice who represented the challengers, called the provision unconstitutional and said it had no basis in the Constitution or Supreme Court precedent. Gould's status as a former state justice didn't go unnoticed. At one point, Bullock mistakenly referred to him as justice. Gould served on the High Court from 2016 to 2021, sharing the bench with several of those who sat before him during oral arguments. The challenges to the disclosure law include Center for Arizona Policy a Christian conservative advocacy organization, Arizona Free Enterprise Club, a libertarian nonprofit, and two anonymous individuals. The groups asked the justices to declare the law unconstitutional, or short of that, issue an injunction to exempt the nonprofits from the law. Justices' questions for Gould mostly revolved around understanding the injunction request, which the nonprofits were seeking to block the law from ever affecting them in the future. Are you saying that this act is applied to your clients in every instance, for every initiative, every candidate, every potential recall in the future, forever? It would be unconstitutional? Timmer asked. Gould said Proposition 211 is categorically chilling on speech. Leaders from the Center for Arizona Policy and Arizona Free Enterprise Club said already the law had stifled their ability to collect donation and conduct advocacy work. Timmer said she could understand an exemption request for a decisive topic, but it's difficult for me to say for every possible initiative that comes up, it would be unconstitutional. Timmer also questioned whether donors to nonprofits had a reasonable expectation of privacy, which Gould said they did. Justices do not have a deadline for deciding the case. An opinion is pending. The next article is titled, How Wastewater Helped Tempe Improve Overdose Response. This article was written by Tufan Upain of the Cronkite News. Tempe has been collecting samples from its sewers for 7 years, looking for traces of opioids flowing through the city pipes. Anyone who flushes a toilet contributes to the data. The testing has detected emerging drug threats, giving authorities more than a week of early warning to prevent spikes in overdoses. This approach to public health has spread, but Tempe was the first to turn wastewater into actionable intelligence about opioid abuse hotspots. One key finding is that opioid use has spread across the city, dispelling stereotypes about good and bad neighborhoods and guiding first responders to prepare for emergencies by deploying naloxone more widely. We were finding not only with our EMS calls, but also with where the wastewater was indicating levels of metabolized opioids. It's across the entire city, said Wydale Holmes, director of Tempe's Strategic Management and Innovation Office. That helped level set and start to stigmatize to what we were able to have these conversations. The testing program works like a citywide health survey. Researchers analyze samples and then post the data on public dashboard that shows opioid in near real time at the neighborhood level. Many U.S. cities also test wastewater for illicit drugs, but only a few besides Tempe post the data publicly, let alone in real time. Wastewater testing that has been conducted in Tempe for 7 years has detected emerging drug threats, giving authorities more than a week of early warning to prevent spikes in overdoses. They were very open to kind of thinking outside the box, said Aaron Driver, an environmental engineer at Arizona State University. Many other cities, she added, were more afraid to see what's in their wastewater. In Tempe, the number of fatal overdoses per year rose 25% between 2019 and 2023, when the city reported 90 overdose deaths. Opioid-related EMS calls also increased from 330 in 2017 to 622 in 2024. But that represented progress, Holmes said. Nothing in that annual increase flattened after 2020 as the city got better at acting on the early warnings. The initiative began in 2018 with a $35,000 city innovation grant. That year, there were 1,116 opioid deaths in Arizona. Maricopa County reports an average of 3 overdose deaths per day from fentanyl. Tempe set a goal of eliminating opioid abuse in the city by 2027. It quickly became apparent that the testing spotted patterns that hadn't shown up in arrests or medical reports yet. The folks on the ground would say, hey, we're seeing more activity in this location. So we tried to link that with what we were seeing in wastewater, Driver said. If we had a spike in activity, it made responders more aware. maybe we need to carry more Narcan. In 2019, the city held an opioid town hall to share findings and reduce stigma, and launched the public online dashboard to inform prevention, treatment, and community health strategies. The program expanded to include COVID-19 monitoring during the pandemic that began in early 2020. Opioid testing was suspended for more than 2 years, resuming in November 2022. Monitoring wastewater for opioids lets public health authorities and law enforcement detect drug threats before overdoses, arrests, and drug seizures spike. The opioid crisis nationwide persists, though it has abated somewhat. In Arizona, the annual death toll peaked at 2015. In 2021, more than double the 2017 toll. According to the state health department, on average, 4 people died in Arizona every day from overdoses through September 11th this year. The 1,116 deaths attributed to opioids is slightly below last year's pace. The city initially partnered with ASU's Biodesign Institute and now works with Aerofens, a commercial testing lab, for its BioIntel wastewater program. The testing includes opioids such as fentanyl, heroin, oxycodone, and codeine. COVID-19 and other respiratory viruses and gastrointestinal viruses and flu strains. Since summer 2024, when wastewater testing was also included, xylazine, a veterinary tranquilizer that is often mixed with fentanyl, a powerful synthetic opioid that is fatal in even tiny amounts. Also known as tranq, xylazine has been FDA approved for animals since 1972 as a sedative and pain reliever. Though not an opioid, it can slow brain function and breathing and lower the heart rate and blood pressure. Unlike fentanyl, xylazine does not respond to naloxone, the overdose treatment sold under the brand name Narcan. Because drug users often consume it unknowingly, community detection is especially helpful for emergency responders. If they respond to a call they think is related to opioids, and the patient isn't responding to Narcan, they then know this could be xylazine, and we need to treat them a little differently, said Holmes. It's never absolute without toxicology, but it helps our teams anticipate and respond more effectively. In July 2024, Tempe's testing program detected xylazine in 5 of 6 collection areas in the course of a single week. Spotting the trends ensured that first responders were prepared with Narcan in the right places and helped target prevention and education efforts, officials said. Wastewater data can tell you if a new drug has entered into our community, and it gives you an early warning of that drug compared to overdose data, said Asparna Keshavia, director of wastewater research at Mathematica, a policy research firm. She co-authored a paper last year detailing an algorithm that used wastewater data from the District of Columbia, Maryland, Virginia, and West Virginia to flag spikes in fentanyl, methamphetamine, cocaine, and xylazine. We found that wastewater data could detect the entry of xylazine into a community at least 1 month before suspected overdoses involving xylazine appeared, she said. The algorithm was adapted from computer modeling developed during the COVID-19 pandemic, and it predicts overdose spikes with 71% to 100% accuracy, providing at least 8 days to prepare. The science is straightforward. When people consume drugs, their bodies break them into metabolites. Labs can determine how much was consumed by testing wastewater for both the parent compound and the metabolized version. Everything from your kitchen sink to your toilet to your tub, all of that goes into a sample, driver said. To protect privacy, each collection zone includes at least 3,000 people. The program does not test sewage from individual homes or businesses. Areas that use septic systems aren't covered because that waste doesn't enter the municipal waste stream. It captures the health of a community even if individuals don't see a doctor or seek treatment for an infectious disease, she said. Since Tempe began testing its sewage for opioids, many other cities have seen similar benefits. In Cary, North Carolina, with a population of 191,000, officials discovered that Narcan use was drastically outpacing the number of reported overdoses, about 25 to 1. Using wastewater data, authorities began distributing Narcan more widely. Opioid-related deaths plummeted from 11 in 2017 to 2 by 2021. In 2023, the National Institute on Drug Abuse issued a contract to BioBot Analytics, a biotechnology company specializing in wastewater-based epidemiology. The company now monitors 70 sites in 43 states, covering about 35 million Americans. Now we'll head over to the business section for an interesting article there. It's titled, Disney Gears Up for Legal Fight Over Kimmel. This article was written by Lucas Shaw of Bloomberg News. Walt Disney Company is preparing for President Donald Trump to retaliate against the company for putting late-night host Jimmy Kimmel back on the air. The company anticipated that the Trump administration might go after its broadcast TV license even before ABC's late show host made his controversial September 15 remarks related to the murder of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, who two people familiar with the company's thinking said. Under the Trump administration, major media companies have faced unprecedented challenges. The president himself sued several companies for alleged bias, in some cases winning settlements that angered free speech advocates, and members of his administration have used their authority to influence coverage. Trump and Federal Communications Commission Chairman Brendan Carr threatened to revoke the broadcast licenses of Disney's local stations, along with those owned by affiliated station owners. The company, parent of the ABC Broadcast Network, seeks regulatory approval from other federal agencies for two deals, one to acquire media assets from the National Football League and another to merge Fubo TV Incorporated with its Hulu Live TV service. Disney's leadership consulted legal experts and is confident it will win a case over broadcast licenses, according to the people who asked not to be identified, discussing its strategy. The FCC attempted to control critical speech in the past with little success. However, the fate of current and future transactions involving the company is less clear. The government has broad powers to meddle in areas of businesses where constitutional questions are less clear-cut. The FCC missed its own informal 180 days deadline to make a decision on Paramount Global's merger with Skydance Media, as Trump's lawyers negotiated a settlement to a lawsuit he filed against CBS News, a division of Paramount. In that case, Trump accused CBS of editing an interview to favor his 2024 election opponent, Kamala Harris. The commission approved the merger following the settlement, along with CBS announcements that it would end Stephen Colbert's late-night program at the end of the season and install an ombudsman to monitor content at CBS News. In the first Trump administration, the Justice Department sued to block the sale of Time Warner to AT&T Incorporated. Though the companies ultimately prevailed, it took almost 2 years to complete that purchase. Last year, Disney paid $16 million, including $1 million in legal fees, to settle a lawsuit the president brought over alleged defamatory comments made by ABC News host George Stephanopoulos. Disney executives knew bringing back Kimmel would anger the president, who was a frequent target of the comedian. Still, they felt they had to defend free speech rights. The company suspended Jimmy Kimmel Live on September 17th. The decision followed an online backlash to the host's comments related to the assassination of Kirk. The blowback included threatening remarks from Carr, who said Disney and its affiliates could lose their broadcast licenses. He encouraged independent owners of ABC stations to pull the program to avoid that. It's really sort of pastime that a lot of those licensed broadcasters themselves push back on Comcast and Disney and say, We're going to preempt. We're not going to run Kimmel anymore until you straighten this out, Carr said in a podcast. Two major stations owners acted. Nexstar Media Group Incorporated and Sinclair Incorporated, owners of ABC stations covering 23% of the U.S., dropped Kimmel Live from their schedules. Both announced they would resume airing the show on the show Friday night. Attempting to revoke a station's owner's license would be a long and difficult process, first within the FCC and probably later in court, since the agency's actions are open to legal challenge. Under the Constitution and the Communications Act, you cannot lose your FCC license for broadcasting something the president doesn't like, said Preston Patton, the former president of ABC Television. Disney intended the hiatus to be temporary from the start, saying the show was suspended indefinitely, not canceled. The company later called Kimmel's remarks ill-timed and insensitive. Kimmel, who had been with Disney for more than 20 years, said he disagreed with the decision and didn't appreciate being taken off the air. He mocked Trump for years without any interference from the company. Chief Executive Officer Bob Iger and entertainment co-star Dana Walden met with Kimmel in person a day after the suspension to mediate their differences. They met again last weekend, paving the way for Kimmel's return. In a social media post Tuesday, Trump floated the possibility of legal action against Disney and suggested Kimmel's on-air criticism could be viewed as paid political speech that Disney is donating to Democrats. He is yet another arm of the DNC, and to the best of my knowledge, it would be a major illegal campaign contribution, the president wrote. I think we're going to test ABC out on this. Let's see how we do. Last time I went after them, they gave me $16 million. This one sounds even more lucrative. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the September 29th, 2025 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.